And now, here are your hosts of Lab Radio, sponsored by Coinstructive.
Hello, this is Aaron Mungle. I'm here with Coinstructive at Bitcoin Miami 2016. I'm here with Chris Groshong.
Hey, guys.
And we're also here with Diego. And how do you say your last name?
Gutierrez Aldivar.
Gutierrez Aldivar. And you're with Rootstock.
That's correct.
And some very interesting stuff you're working on. You just gave a talk a little bit ago, and some very inspiring thinking there. So first tell us a little bit about yourself. Like, how did you get to this point, and what's your background? And then we'd love to hear about Rootstock.
Excellent. Thank you for having me with you here. My background is that I was one of the pioneers of the web back in the 90s in Latin America. And I always look for technology that had the ability to disrupt society. And that's how I got involved in the internet back then. And after many years of not feeling the same type of connection with anything, in 2011, early 2012, I got in touch with Bitcoin. And at the early beginning, I didn't get it, to be quite frank.
Mm-hmm. What is this?
Yes, and then I was like 15 days, almost non-sleeping, reading about it.
Wow. All
from the technical point of view, social impact, the economic. I had to learn about financial aspects of the macroeconomics of the world, because, you know, it touches so many different aspects of the human life that you have to expand your knowledge to really understand it. And after that, I decided to drop. I had a web development company back then, so I went to my partners and I said, sorry guys, but I found my next thing. So you take care of the company, I will devote in full to Bitcoin. And since then, I did everything. I started mining, I started meeting with people to buy and sell Bitcoins in cafes, because I wanted to know who was involved. I started with my partners on the NGO, we started the first meetup. After those meetups start growing, we had like 100 and 150 people in every meetup. And the thing grew so far that we decided to do the first Latin American Bitcoin conference at the end of 2013 in Buenos Aires. And at the same time, I launched my first project with my partner, who is now the CEO of that project, called Coibanks, with the idea of creating the bank of the future, like creating a bank that would be accessible for anybody. And along that path I took, is like I was connecting to the people who really could need a new financial system, because I think in the first world, you don't need it that much.
You have it good, you know? It's like, you know, discount on Starbucks is like what you have to do to incentivize people, whereas other people are losing the value of their currency.
By doing nothing.
Yeah.
Just by holding on.
Right.
Yeah, and in Argentina we had 30, 40% inflation per year. So imagine that. And people were kind of comfortable with it because they don't know any better. And then, of course, they try to protect their wealth, but there are only a few ways to do it, and there's almost no way to do it if you are outside the financial system, because if you are unbanked, then you cannot even ask for a little loan, because you have no collateral. Some of them have no identity. So along the way of building the Latin American Bitcoin community, we have 10 countries in the community now, I find out the real need for Bitcoin was there in the bank of Latin America, and of course in the bank of the world, but my reach is within Latin America, so that was my focus. And for many years I was thinking, how can Bitcoin fulfill that need? And I felt like there was one piece missing. Mm-hmm. And Rootstock is that. I mean, Rootstock, from my point of view, is the missing part to make this happen, to turn the promise that Bitcoin always offered us, to make it a reality. Mm-hmm. So that's it. That summarizes process.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Buenos Aires.
Oh, and cool.
Yes.
So you're very intimately aware of the state of the market, and you saw the effect on the people firsthand.
Yes.
Because these were your peers and people you knew.
Yes, and I passed through a very deep crisis. 2001 was an awful crisis in Buenos Aires, kind of what the Greeks had recently. And you could see it in the streets. I mean, you could see everybody was
just down.
Demolished by the situation. Even the middle class, it was not only, so it was very strong. And I think what happened in 2008 and 2009 is just the same thing on a global scale. Mm. But I had like a first contact with what it happens when the financial system collapses.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it was very unfair because they saved the banks that were speculating that created a crisis. So the people was paying to sabotage these financial institutions that were very, I would say, I don't know.
They don't answer to anyone.
Yeah, very unresponsible in the way they behave. Because if you're a financial institution and you put, 60% of your portfolio into a high-risk asset, you know the chances are you're going to be bankrupt. So if you go bankrupt, you should be responsible for your decisions, not make the government or the people pay
foot
for
the bill,
that.
Yeah.
Yes, and that was what happened in Argentina back in 2001.
And so when did rootstock emerge from, obviously you had grew up there and you saw the struggles, you learned about Bitcoin, and then when did, rootstock come into the picture?
Well, the first talk about rootstock started in 2014, in October. I happened to crash by Nick Szabo in Palo Alto, because a friend of mine was walking me through, and he joined us for a glass of white wine and started talking about, I was talking about my hopes for the cryptocurrency ecosystem. He's a brilliant guy. He was explaining me his vision and sharing ideas, and we were not happy with the new projects that were taking smart contracts away from Bitcoin. Like, instead of building on the network effect Bitcoin already has built, we're like creating their own token, their own, like, not leveraging on everything we have built. Because at the end, it's not only technology, it's the user base, it's the companies building solutions on top of it, it's a security model that has a certain level of maturity, and that, you know, creating a new security model will take some time. It's not that it's impossible.
Why reinvent the wheel? We've got this whole infrastructure and user base built up. Might as well utilize that versus trying to start from ground zero.
Yes, and I think smart contracting itself is a very challenging thing. So instead of trying to attack five different challenging subjects, why not focus on one and make it well, and build on top, on the shoulders of what you already have, where it's not the best, it's usable enough. So in that sense, when we created Rootstock, we created with this pragmatic vision, saying we don't want to have a state-of-the-art platform. We want to have a platform that people can use today. So that was the concept, and we started with very specific use cases, mostly for DenBank. But there are other use cases you can build in other industries. And since Rootstock went open, it was in the open air, a lot of people who is developing solutions over Ethereum or other platforms is reaching out and saying, how can I port my solution to Rootstock? Because they see the value of having a Turing complete smart contracts platform that runs on Bitcoin security. So,
got it.
It's very impressive. Like, to actually just, first of all, the idea, right, end of 2014, to have a working model now.
Yeah.
It's very impressive, so congratulations.
Thank you. We are still on the alpha. We still need to finish the Fed peg, because I don't know if you know about the sidechains, but the sidechains have two ways, one from the main chain to the secondary chain,
okay. And
then you have the way back. The way from the main chain to the secondary chain, in our case is Rootstock, it can be completely automated, but the way back is not. So we had to create a federation that will sign the transactions back to the Bitcoin blockchain. So we are finishing that part, and then we'll have the alpha running. But we are running smart contracts on Rootstock. We are doing everything there is to be done. So I think, yes, we're doing good progress. In big part is because Sergio, our chief scientist, he's brilliant. He's a really, like, everybody who talks with him is very knowledgeable, very open with his knowledge, very easy to work with. And he brought with him his former team from his former projects. So we got some head start. It's not nice. That we started from the
you had
from
good, scratch. Good team, good talent.
Yes, and a previous experience that were put into Rooster.
So let's look at some use cases. You talk about smart contracts in your talk. You mentioned also the unbanked, which to me sounds like a huge benefit of this. Are there any other big sort of pieces to this in terms of the use cases that you could go over?
There are many that are maybe less appealing to me from an ideological point of view,
sure.
But they are as big in terms of economic incentives. I think the insurance industry has a lot to gain from transparency, and also private money flows can be developed once you have smart contracting platform. A lot of models today, like referral models, work on trust. I mean, you send a referral to somebody, and that somebody might or might not honor the agreement. When you use tokens issued by yourself, you can track how that referral or transfer of value follow through the path to your partners and back to you.
And previously, we did not have that data, or
exactly.
Not a good way to measure it.
No way to weigh. So new flows of value will emerge from having these tools, and
quantifiable too.
Quantifiable. So in loyalty programs, there's a big opportunity. I think there are many. We have identified four or five use cases that can be done today, and you know, we are focusing on micro lending. We are talking with development banks in Latin America, and also with worldwide entities. We talk with World Bank. We talk with IFC. Also with the Development Bank of Brazil, we are starting conversations. So we are moving on both sides, is developing the core of Rootstock and then doing the commercial work to bring use cases from the get-go into the platform.
With smart contracts, what's the innovation there? You know, I hear that term thrown around a lot, and I don't necessarily fully get, like, how is that different than, like, an escrow or, like, just transferring money to somebody? You know, I understand there's maybe some contingencies built in, but I don't really fully get this all the details.
Let me, it's difficult to exemplify this in a simple
yeah, I know, right? We need, like, a whole session on that.
But let's say you want to set a contract in Bitcoin where you allow a certain amount of money to be released every day, and not a penny more per day than that. Scripting in Bitcoin doesn't have a state that can be, it's not stateful. You cannot save the amount of money sent so far. You cannot do that. Mm-hmm. With a smart contract, you not only have the opportunity to run a script that is more powerful than the Bitcoin scripting, I mean, with a Turing complete smart contract, because Bitcoin has a smart contract, but it's limited smart contracts. With a Turing complete smart contract, you can run this contract and save the state of that contract. So you can keep building on top of the last execution state. Mm. And that's key, because that persistence of results over time is that what enables more powerful interactions with the platform.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that answers your question, but in general, I mean, that's only a very simple example of things you cannot do with Bitcoin and you can do with a Turing complete smart contract.
Right, and I mean, another probably worth pointing out is that this is happening digitally, no intermediaries. I mean, that's kind of easy to forget. That's part of the framework, right, is that you're disintermediation, they say. So I think, because I'm just trying to paint the picture for people that maybe don't have any idea of smart contracts, so like they might ask, well, what's the difference between, like I said, escrow? And I think to me the difference is it's happening digitally, it's still robust and secure, but you don't necessarily need all these people involved, which is why the current system,
sorry.
You know, you've got
yes.
the guy at the desk,
yes.
right?
Yes, I went one step.
No, it's fine. No, that's great. I just wanted to bring it back to
ground
level.
I completely agree with you. And in the stack I showed during my presentation, what I did is I had this arrow pointing up saying decentralized. what all these layers have in common, Bitcoin, rootstock, Lightning Network, decentralized applications, what all they have in common is the decentralization, is the non-trust on a third party. So that's very important, because smart contracts have been possible for many years. You have open transactions, you have other smart contracts platforms, but the key thing is to have it in a decentralized network. And then when you talk about decentralized network, you have to see what's the security model of that decentralized network. So that's where we have a differential with other.
So that you've built on sort of pre-existing pieces, and you've put them together in a unique
yes.
way. And I think, I don't know, someone made the comment at dinner or something about a remix, like everything's a remix. And I think that's brilliant.
Yes, and we have, I mean, I could list a lot of differentials. We have like key things that we invent, we created from scratch, like because we have we have a protocol that is called Decor that was created by Sergio and combined with Ghost, and that protocol, for example, has no orphan blocks. So one problem in Bitcoin that nobody talks that much is that with maybe 30% of the network, you can do what is called a selfish mining attack. So a selfish mining attack is the miner that has that much amount of power, instead of releasing the block instantly when he finds it, he holds it as long as he can. So he has a head start, and once he sees somebody else pushing a block into the network, he pushes his block right there and try to win, and he has a lower latency to do so. So his block gets in, and then he has all the head start from the time he got the block until he actually published the block. So in a way, with 30% of the network, like, if you do so, you have the possibility of perpetrating you as the block issuer all the time. With the non-orphanage we have in Rusto, that percentage goes to 50%. So you put it equal to the 51% attack that you have in Bitcoin. So there are many different things. Another thing we have in Rootstock is we can have lightweight clients that don't require an intermediary to use user-issued assets. Let's say you create your own coin. If you use Counterparty, you need to download the full blockchain into your cell phone in order to verify the last position of that colored coin. So the solution now is to create an intermediary server you can query, because you cannot have the full blockchain into a cell phone.
Right.
With Rootstock, you don't need that because of how it's built. So we can have distributed applications that work with assets issued by users and then interact directly with the Rootstock network without intermediaries. So that's real decentralization.
Right.
So that's very important. And it's, many of those things are the things that we are putting into Rootstock. That, again, is not something we built just now. It's the work of Sergio of many years of research, discussions with the community, and that's...
So when you were looking into building, you know, building this out, and you have a background from, you know, you were involved with the internet and very early on, and could you talk about some of the similarities that you see between the two spaces as they're both emerging in their infancies, or as they were emerging in their infancies?
Well, I learned a lot from my participation on the early days of the web, and one thing is the camaraderie among the people. It's like when we started on the web, the early beginners, we were like always sharing our knowledge. We had this conscience that growing together was the only way to grow, like
at all.
You know, because we were so few that otherwise we would been swallowed, and you had opponents to the web as well. you had people saying the web was for porn, so for child pornography. You have all these things on the web. So it's not that the web just emerged smoothly and became the
right
super smooth, super, all one touch, one no. click. No, all of a sudden, no.
No,
it was evolution.
And people were looking at you like you were crazy. Like
now, everyone is on their phone, not realizing there was all this.
No, and nobody could imagine living without the internet. That's how it works. So, in that, I have the same feeling with Bitcoin, and people is sometimes eager to rebut Bitcoin and say it's dead or
yeah.
but I think Bitcoin is an evolving thing. Bitcoin is growing, and if we manage to create these layers on top of the basic layer that Bitcoin provides, we'll be able to change how money flows in the humankind. So that is huge. That is huge. And then if you look at from a technological perspective, the web had all the elements to create Facebook back in the 90s. You didn't have the cultural acceptance or transformation of the user base. But now we have the user base, and what I think we need to follow through is you know, with this cultural acceptance or understanding of this new technology. But it will be faster than the web. I think mm-hmm. The web took like 18 years until you could say it really emerged as a global thing in 2010, and the social networks were blooming there. I think Bitcoin will take, you know, much less time than mm-hmm. to achieve the same level of acceptance.
There's like insights that we've learned from the web that now are pretty obvious, right? And so it's like those mistakes hopefully won't be repeated, and there's new problems to be solved, new mistakes maybe to be made. But to your point, it's everything's happening faster. The infrastructure is just different now with the
exactly.
use of the cloud and, you know, just internet access, network access.
Exactly. So I see this happening faster than we imagine. Maybe, I don't know, it will take 10 years, 15, but it will be faster for sure. Mm.
Do you see any hesitation by the Latin American community tied to like stereotypes of like what money should be or technology and fear? Because I personally have seen through just my experience with people in general here in the U.S. that the biggest reason they don't want to try something is because they're afraid of it, because they don't understand. So, you just touch on that?
Yes, and there is for sure. And that's part of the cultural challenge I think we face. And one of the programs we are doing with the NGO is called Sistema D, and it's like the last mile for this project of financial inclusion. So we are working with people in the slums. We are actually working with them, and we invite them to our meetups to offer their products. They do dumplings, so they come with them to the meetups and sell their dumplings. And we teach them how to use a digital wallet and how to get paid in Bitcoin. And we realize we got it wrong. We had to go back to drawing board and say, you know, create a much easier solution. And we are in that process now. So I for sure see a lot of cultural, I would say challenges in that sense, and we are working on that on creating solutions that are targeted to, you know, the regular user, somebody that is not tech savvy, that it's but that needs the technology.
Mm-hmm.
So if we find a way to create tools that are giving a solution to an actual need, then all those problems will go away, all the fears will go away.
Yes, because they will want to try it regardless because they know it's a solution.
Yes, I can give you one example that is very powerful. People in the slums don't have a way to save. They have to leave the money, the bills under the mattress. So every time they go to work, they are, you know, crossing fingers, praying to whatever God there is, not to get mugged. So just giving them a way to save their money in mm-hmm. a safe way on a digital wallet, that would be life-changing.
Yeah, they can carry their money in their phone and their with them to work.
Yes, and you can have a time locking system.
Yeah.
So they will only have available a small amount of money, and every 2 days or 3 days they will unlock more money as they need it. But they will never be carrying the full amount of money. Those are the kinds of solutions that we are targeting. And you know, I don't want to give you gruesome samples, but some people got mad and badly hurt because they were carrying their whole monthly salary in their pocket.
Mm-hmm. So, because they didn't want to leave it under their mattress. They felt like they'd rather just keep it with them.
Or they had to carry it until they got to their mattress. So on the way from work to home, they got mugged. So if we manage to give solutions to those problems, that are not your problems, my problems, we might be thinking about financing. They are not even thinking about it.
They're just trying to survive.
Absolutely. And sorry, I don't want to overextend, but there's one more thing that is very important. It's kind of proven that an entrepreneur that sells that is poor and sells to the surroundings, to the people who is as poor as himself or herself, will be always in survival mode. Will never be able to thrive because the margins are so low. And we had this experience firsthand. This micro entrepreneur from the slum came to a meetup, and she asked us, "Well, I don't know how much to charge for my dumplings because it's." And we asked her, "Well, what do you charge usually?" She told us, "Well, I charge $5. Anywhere outside the slums, a dumpling costs $10 to $15 pesos. No, not U.S. dollars, but it's like about a dollar." So she was charging 50 cents of a dollar per dumpling. So for her, selling her dumplings outside the slum means that she can have a profit that is maybe five times. Because, it's, you know, the profit for her maybe was 10 cents. Mm-hmm. So suddenly she has 60 cents of profit. And that people, it's not that they are getting rich. I mean, every penny they get will go to enhance their life or of their loved ones and the surroundings. So if you want to really transform society and you know, end poverty, that's a way to do it. Creating a bridge between the ones that are wealthier and the ones who are not.
Yeah.
And educating and building the tools for them to be safer. And that's a vision we are like following.
That's incredible.
Yeah,
I love that.
Yeah, I'm like letting that process. That's really so powerful. Like, I like how you kind of got into the problems and specifically how it could happen. Now I kind of see the internet, like, you know, like Mark Zuckerberg's trying to push internet access out, Google's trying to push internet access out. These are great things because
absolutely,
the more access people have, and we already know that, you know, there's more people having the phones than drinking water. So I'm thinking, okay, well, if you have a phone, then theoretically we could get the resources to the person directly. And then if you had other people, boots on the ground, to kind of help maybe implement stuff, I mean,
yes,
there's a lot that could happen.
Yes, and I think, you know, some people would say, no, we have people who is having hunger and you're thinking about connectivity. Well, connectivity now, it's a possibility for that people to access to resources,
it's
to
not
improve
just like
their life. So it's exactly. We think about internet connectivity.
It's like,
from our perspective, right?
Right.
But it's not their perspective.
And this is grounding and kind of healthy to me to like kind of go back to, like, you know what I mean? It's healthy to go to that, like,
absolutely,
put ourselves in their shoes, walk a mile, right, in their shoes. Wow.
So, moving along, I was wondering if you would want to tell us about your definitions of what a Bitcoin is and what a blockchain is. So can we start with what you feel Bitcoin is to you?
Well, a Bitcoin for me is a share of one of the most amazing experiments in the humankind these days.
Oh, nice answer. I like that.
And the blockchain is an amazing technology, but without the proper economic incentives, is no more than a database on steroids. So, the Bitcoin blockchain is the thing. I mean, that's the real thing.
It's, you think they're kind of, there's this intertwining that people are trying to sort of separate them, but you're saying these pieces fit together and have contributed to the whole.
I like to do the same comparison between the intranets and the internet, because we have another analogy or comparison we can do. Back then we had this discussion. No, the internet were the thing, and the internet was going nowhere. And at the end, everything is about network effect in this kind of technology. So if you do a private blockchain, it's okay. You can do a better Swift. Maybe you can lower wire transactions, international wire transactions. You can lower them from $40 or $25 to $5. But you're not going to create a financial inclusion platform with that, because you are trusting a limited number of incumbents. So it's the difference between the internet and the internet. With an internet, you can distribute information better within a corporation, but you're not going to change the world. You're not going to open knowledge to any little kid out there through an internet. So think about it in the same way, and you will realize why private blockchains are nice, but are not the thing.
The full thing will get us all the way. Yeah. One question I always ask, and I feel like you've already maybe answered it, but I'm going to ask anyway. If you could wave a magic wand, what would you change about the technology or the industry?
Well, I wouldn't change anything because I think this is a learning process. I think instead of being upset on our failures, we should just learn and understand that this, as I said, this is a big experiment and it is still ongoing and thriving because there's a lot of energy put into it and a lot of hope put into it. So I would say let's learn, let's enjoy the ride. This is not going to be a sprint, this is a marathon. So anybody that wants to get it right in a year or two is missing the point. We are doing an experiment on a global scale.
It's gonna take a while.
Yes.
So you have sort of the Latin American focus in terms of the market and the culture. So you might have some unique resources to share to people that want to get started, not only with Bitcoin, but maybe if they want to learn about issues going on in the other countries. Like what you've said is actually something really important to, I think, focus on beyond just like, yay, saving money on a purchase. Whereas you could be solving really big problems. So how would what are some things you would encourage people to look at, starting points for beginners or just new people?
Well, I think the best way to start with a complex technology is to use it. So what I always recommend people is, if you want to acquire Bitcoins, don't change your fiat currency for Bitcoins. Offer your services, offer your products for Bitcoins. Yeah. Start to get engaged in the Bitcoin economy. If you want to build something, use it. Pay with it. Use different applications. It's too complex to understand it from an abstract point of view, reading white papers. And the other thing is there is no like single source of knowledge that express what Bitcoin is in a very clear manner. So you have to poke around until you really get it.
Right.
I mean, it took me maybe 2 years until I really understood the full depth of it. And I'm not saying I have understood it, but until I had like a general understanding of the implications of different things.
Mm-hmm. 15 all-nighters later,
yeah.
You know a little more than when you started.
Yes,
great. Absolutely. Well, before we find out how to get in touch with you, did you have any other
Making time today.
Thank you for inviting me. It has been very nice to talk with you.
How do we get in touch with you? And obviously plug Rootstock. Is it rootstock.com or .io?
It's .io.
.io. Okay, rootstock.io. Yes. Shameless plug. But how do we get in touch with you?
My Twitter is Dieguito, like little Diego.
Dieguito?
Yes, it's Dieguito.
Great.
And then you can write an email to dgz@rootstock.io. And I will be happy to answer any questions. And also, if we want to get in touch with the NGO I lead, I'm also happy to assist in that.
Great. Well, thank you for your time and what you're doing. Very inspiring, and look forward to following your work.
Yeah.
Thank you. Look forward to do things together.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks.